This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com.
So I got something. I don't think we'll talk about it quite as long as that, but I just listened to an audiobook of Dick Trotter's Cultural Revolution, A People's History. And what struck me as interesting about that is, you know, one way to appreciate it is just like all like, oh, here's these atrocities and here's all these various things. But at a very grand level, what the Cultural Revolution was about Mao trying to maintain control against the party apparatus. And he did so by mobilizing kind of a grassroots and telling them, attack the party apparatus. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, where have I seen this before? Why does this seem familiar? And I realized it's something you see in people like Polybius and Fukuyama, who argue that traditionally there's three big social classes. There's the monarch, there's the oligarchs, and then there's the demos, you know, the people. And it's wrong to think of the monarch as part of the oligarchy. And very often oligarchies fiercely resist monarchs. And, you know, that was the story of the Roman Revolution in the first century BC, is it was fundamentally the oligarchy versus the monarchy, that is to say the Senate versus Caesar. And here's this case, but, you know, you can, historically, the monarch is very often allied with the demos against the oligarchy, right? It's the common people and the monarchy against the nobility. And that's effectively what you had in the Cultural Revolution, in that you had the party chairman allied with the Red Guards and the party cadre and the, you know, basically high school students who he told, you know, go beat up your teachers, go beat up the local party officials, because he was scared that the party officials would push him out on the model of Khrushchev versus Stalin.
Okay, so obviously when you're talking about oligarchy, you're talking about like super elites in the ancient world or in China. But, you know, I was thinking a little bit. Stop me if this is way off base of what you're talking about, but I was thinking a little bit about the tax debate right now about 401ks and, you know, cutting taxes on the rich.
Yeah.
And so a 401, and a lot of it is being construed as pitting the middle class versus the versus elites. But if you take a look at the personal finances of people who have 401ks, it's like 10-15% of people have anything serious in the way of 401k holdings. And you see that a lot of the distributional battles that are being waged right now are like, they're like that privileged group that we're definitely part of, right? That privileged 10 or so percent, the dream hoarders against the super elite.
Oh, no, I think that's true, right? So you're making a good connection, right? I was talking about something where it's like, unless you're an ancient history nerd like me, you'd have no connection to it. But, you know, the more abstract way to say this is that you can have top-bottom coalitions against the middle, or alternately, you can have the middle against the top and the bottom. You know, we don't want to assume that one side is necessarily the aggressor. And that, to a certain extent, does describe our politics, and that, you know, you can have one party that kind of unites the bottom in terms of social class and some factions of the elites. And then you have another political party that unites the middle class and some factions of the elite.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think it's playing out not just in our politics, but, you know, also on the local level. I mean, we see across the country in places, you know, where there's been significant demographic change. And by that, I mean neighborhoods in which higher income individuals have moved in and kind of and sort of started pushing out lower income people. Now, all of a sudden, then turning around and saying, okay, fine, now we need to fight for affordable housing, right? meaning housing affordable for people like us, right? Not low enough for those people that we displaced, right? But protecting us against, you know, against those people who are even wealthier than we are, who are trying to encroach on our territory.
It strikes me like so much of our politics is basically, yeah, it's like it's a fight at the top. And I don't think either party seems to really represent people at the bottom. It's basically like that university educated class who are all the journalists and teachers and all that pitted against the billionaires. So there's just a total indifference to on all fronts towards people at the bottom.
Yeah, total indifference to people at the bottom, right? Where, you know, it's that was something that I thought was so remarkable, not to get back to politics, but, you know, in the last, you know, presidential election, I was like, where are all the poor people?
Wait a minute, how right? can you say there's a total indifference? I mean, one of the major political issues of the last 6 months was whether to preserve a large Medicaid expansion.
Right.
Well, so the Medicaid expansion isn't necessarily for poor people. The reason why it was expanded was to include working class
people.
Well,
okay, so it's not just for poor people, it's for near poor people. So
I actually think that that's one of the reasons why people were against the Medicaid expansion, because they were like, if we're going to have Medicaid, it's got to be for poor people, right? These other people, I don't know, they just work harder. And so, I mean, if you think about it, in some places that Medicaid expansion is actually quite generous.
It's like a lot of Medicaid's for old people. Like, regardless.
Well, but that's true in the form that a lot of Medicaid is actually for middle-class people who've spent down their savings and use it for nursing homes.
Yeah.
But but that's not the cultural image, and therefore, even if that's objectively true, it's not what people are fighting about. People perceive Medicaid as healthcare for poor people or near poor people nowadays.
Yeah, and so that's what I'm saying is I actually think the reality about, you know, whether or not there had been a discussion about during the presidential election, hey, why aren't we looking out for poor people, right? And the working poor, they were totally absent. And then, you know, for the first time in a while.
I like your idea of while the fireworks factory is exploding, we should be reading my white paper.
How do Americans tolerate that? Like, not to be whatever, but like...
Oh, now you're not an American anymore. Now you're Canadian. And we're talking about 2016.
I take my American hat on and off.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I can't say I blame you, Joe. I can't say I blame you. How do we tolerate it? It's part of our culture.
But we like, really, what is it?
We go out of our way to blame poor people, no matter what happens to them. It's their fault. We go out of our way to do that. Even people who are just above, I shouldn't say even people, especially people who are recently not poor, right? Like they just got off of welfare. They're the main moralizers talking about how people need to work harder, right? And this also cuts across racial lines as well. You know, many African Americans and Latinos, you know, I love Celeste Watkins Hayes' book when she looks at welfare offices and the bureaucrats there that are disproportionately people of color. Really are blaming they really have a tough time with the people of color that they're supposed to service, right? So they do a lot of basically victim blaming for people who are in those circumstances, and that's part of our culture. That's like a major pastime of America. Like, it's not just on Fox News, it's done in a more subtle way through other media outlets, but it's the poor are seen as this political football where they have no control, no agency, right? And that's by good lefty liberals, or everything's their fault, right? And they have a culture of poverty, which can explain everything about them. So this has been a tired conversation that we've been engaged in for years. I don't know how to really push us beyond this. And it cuts across multiple cleavages. It seems to be like an urban northern conversation, but, you know, it's also dominates regions, across regions and rurality. So in the South, you know, this is a huge conversation. I live in the South. I've studied the South. And in rural communities as well, this is this type of moralizing. And it fits in even with our religion. So this move towards Americans being more into the gospel of prosperity, the prosperity gospel, it you know, they forgot the book of Job, not to turn this into a sermon or proselytizing or anything, but good, quote unquote, good Christian folks who go to these churches that emphasize the prosperity gospel. It's who we are in America.
I mean, it's like, you know, I don't know if any of you read that book by Nancy Eisenberg, White Trash.
What'd it say?
So, I mean, it's, you know, it's not an easy read. I actually hate her writing style. But she basically, she's like, this whole history of despising poor folk in America has been around since before we were America, right? It's been 400 years in the making. And, you know, we have that term white trash for a reason. You know, it's because there are certain class of people who upon arrival in this country who were basically treated as totally disposable, right?
So her,
I'm not talking about slaves. I'm not talking about slaves because you had to pay for them.
Right. These are white. Yeah. So Hillbilly Elegy. Yeah. I've been trying to make it through that book, and I have such a hard time because it's basically the whole culture of poverty argument applied to poor whites. Huh. So if we're doing this, if white supremacy is set up where we're doing this to poor whites, right? Mm-hmm. What chance do people of color have, right? You see all the polls where Trump supporters believe that, and I'm not just saying this is race or class, it's a combination of both of these things, an intersection along gender and sexual orientation as well. If Trump supporters, a majority of folks that voted for Trump, think that white people are the most discriminated against group.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen that.
The group, this is just like, that's the craziest thing I've ever heard of, right? Like, what empirical evidence? If white people in this country are doing bad, the rest of us really, if they're being discriminated against and they're doing bad because of discrimination, people of color, women, just should not get out of bed.
Like, yeah, well, John, what other explanation can there be if a white man isn't successful, if it isn't discrimination?
Yeah. Well, so the you got me. So John mentioned Hillbilly Elegy. I haven't read that, but I have been reading the last few feature articles by Kevin Williamson in National Review, which are very much, I mean, basically his last few articles could be called, you know, White Trash Chronicles 1-3, where he's been writing these features basically talking about how, you know, poor whites are very often extremely dysfunctional in their habits and have a lot of self-created problems. And he has an interesting point in that when conservatives look at problems of black people, say, they'll be very quick to bring up issues of self-destructive behavior or, you know, behavior that's not necessarily the most conducive, so extramarital fertility, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then he's pointing out that there's a little bit more of a understanding or compassion or whatever in the case of white trash. And he's actually arguing that people should be skeptical, critical, and attribute individual responsibility for problems in both cases. And he brings up examples of like his own mother having all sorts of problems that were entirely her fault. Mm. So he's kind of talking. So it's an interesting perspective in what it argues, and similar to Hillbilly Elegy, in that he's also talking about his own background.
So I have two comments on that. Now, number one is, so I'm from Canadian mining country. Nobody will know that. Maybe if somebody from Canada, but basically, I'm from the Canadian version of mining country, and it's socialist. But that makes sense. Because you would expect people who are in an economically distressed community to be very much in favor of socialism. Like I can't get my head around sort of the strong animosity towards redistribution and socialism that sort of seems to be taken up by poor whites in our
America. Well, we used to have poor whites are disproportionately rural, right? That you're going to have higher concentration of poor whites in rural communities. So if you look at like the Appalachians, there used to be a strong sense of organizing, like against the coal companies. There's a great movie called Matawan, which shows development. It's almost like a documentary. It feels very much like a documentary, but it traces some of that, the same history you're talking about, the workers' rights and people organizing and unionizing, right? Mm-hmm. The issue is that poor whites have been, and I hate to sound like just like a straight up Marxist here, opiate of the masses sort of thing, but culturally, even if they don't go to church all the time, right? The culture, even if they're secular, the culture about this so-called war on Christmas and all of these other, these cultural wars that folks have engaged in, and religion is a basis of it, right? This very conservative religion that we, a very conservative Christianity that we have in this country, permeates these areas, permeates these communities, and that's why we get what we get here. It's cultural, more than anything, but it's not the culture of poverty. It's just dominant ideology.
You know, one thing that I really can relate to with these, you know, West Virginian Republicans and the Northern Ontarians that I'm from is this dislike of high-minded big city folk and a feeling of being debased or, you know, devalued in the general national conversation, being treated like hicks and things like that. And maybe they just react in a different direction. I just wanted to quickly interject that. Gabe, did you have something to say?
Yeah, so I had two thoughts on what John said, all of which I pretty much agree with. So one is, you said they have this conservative religious background, even if they don't go to church. That actually was a huge cleavage in the Republican primary, in that evangelicals who went to church all voted for Cruz, and evangelicals who didn't go to church all voted for Trump. So there was there's a difference between having this identity and in some way practicing it, and having this identity and having it as a source of resentment. And, you know, as Ross Douthat always says, if you don't like the Christian right, wait till you see the post-Christian right. And that pretty much seems to have been the story of this election. And then my other thought is that everything you're saying about America could also apply to France, in that, you know, that you have these kind of rural downscale whites who a generation or two ago, many of them would have been communists. Now they're all Front National.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.